Hey, Patty, you're at the controls today, is that correct? Good, good, good. It's a pleasure to be here again. And my topic is Widening Horizons, the Limitless Nature of Spiritual Development. First slide, please, Patty. So in the early years after Jesus' death, the Christian community was very tied to its original Jewish roots. Its main traditions and texts were primarily Jewish ones, and the members were, no surprise, mainly Jewish. But because folks like Paul, himself a Jew, had been trekking into far-flung corners of the Mediterranean world, spreading the good news of Christ and God's love, an increasing proportion of converts to the new Christian way were non-Jews or Gentiles. And this raised a very critical issue that had to be discussed and dealt with head on at what we now know as the Council of Jerusalem, kind of the first general council, if you will, of the Christian community, which Paul and Barnabas and others traveled to from far-flung corners of modern Turkey over some pretty rugged territory without the benefit of a Range Rover, a Hummer, or a four-wheeler, or any of that sort of mode of transportation, so that they could attend that very important event. Because at stake at this Council of Jerusalem was the question of what rules or what requirements would be laid upon new converts to the Christian way in order for them to be considered true Christians. Some of the Christians in Jerusalem were from this, the Pharisee sect, as Anne mentioned, or as she read in the passage just now. And they had a more restrictive and more precise understanding of what was required in order to be a true follower of Jesus. In fact, they had been going around in the same sort of areas where Paul and Barnabas and others had been preaching in the Mediterranean world and saying to the Gentiles, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Now, just a pause here. If you're unsure what circumcision is, I'm not going to explain it. I will not provide any videos or diagrams. You can Google it when you get home, okay? Agreed? Good. I'm sure it was a very heated debate because we know that discussions like this are not easy to have, such as in the United Church of Canada. We've had a few heated discussions over the years. But they finally agreed that to be saved, whatever exactly that phrase means, didn't hinge on being circumcised. As Paul later wrote, in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is of any avail, but faith working through love. So having reminded each other at this Council of Jerusalem, how for Jesus himself, it mattered not whether you were a Jew, a Roman, a Samaritan, a tax collector, a leper, a prostitute, an outcast of some sort, they concluded, they reminded themselves of the all-inclusive nature of God's love as demonstrated in Jesus. They concluded, quote, and I'm reading from the RSV, that he made no distinction between us and them, but cleansed their hearts by faith. Now, some 2,000 years later, that meeting so long ago might seem to us like a tempest in a teapot. Who cares whether that meeting took place? But if the policy of circumcision for men had prevailed and the principle of inclusion had been lost, we likely wouldn't be here today in St. Paul's Church. Were it not for Paul and Barnabas and others who championed this wider, broader vision of what faith involves, the Christian way might well have died out. Instead, it widened out until eventually, in its heyday, it penetrated every corner of our planet. From the get-go, the faith that we're rooted in has been an outward-reaching movement, one of continually widening horizons. Now, it's due to debates like they had at the Council of Jerusalem that spiritual communities of one sort or another evolve in the ways that they do. Never smoothly, to be sure, because periods of widening are often followed by periods of narrowing in. It's like one step forward and one or two steps backward kind of thing. But it's how society as a whole evolves as well, as we keep widening our horizons as to what the human family is all about. As we come to accept, for instance, here we are on the eve of another election, as we come to accept that women have as much right to vote as men do, that slavery is an abomination, that Black lives and Asian lives matter just as much as white lives do, that Indigenous peoples deserve an apology and more for the discrimination and the extermination that they've been subjected to over the centuries, that those who identify as other than heterosexual have the same rights as anyone else, and that plants and animals have every bit as much right as we humans do to survive on this little blue planet, and so on and so forth. Spiritual development and development of any sort entails continually widening our horizons. Now, we can resist that widening, as some people choose to do, or we can embrace it, but it's going to happen anyway. It's the way that we're wired. So I want to talk with you a little bit now about some of the ways, the different ways in which we're wired to widen. Next slide, please, Patty. First of all, cognitive development. We tend naturally to widen out cognitively or intellectually as we age, in terms of both what and how we think. As far as the what is concerned, it's true, yes, that as we get a little older, we lose some of the speed of computer processing in our brains and so forth. That just seems to be the way that things go. But what we may lose in speed, we more than make up for in terms of the experience and the knowledge and the content that we accumulate to think about. And that theoretically knows no bounds. It can keep on widening in limitless ways, especially nowadays with advances in technology and a universe of information now available to us at our fingertips on our cell phones. It's incredible. I don't know about you, but the older I get, the curiouser I become. Maybe it's the researcher in me, because when you research a topic, for every one answer you might get, two or three more questions bubble up from below. But I find my world getting wider, not narrower. The pile of books beside my favorite reading chair is getting taller, not smaller. Maybe it's the same for you. The more we know, the more we realize we don't know, and the more, hopefully, we want to learn. It's like becoming a little child all over again. What's that? How come? Why? That's why we need centers like Stepping Stone and the Third Age in our communities, so they can keep providing us with opportunities for lifelong learning. Next slide. Psychosocial development. From fetus to toddler, from teen to adult, we physically widen all the more as we get older, some of us more so than others. But in internal or subtler ways, we widen as we move from one stage of life to the next. Take education. There are educators here in the group today. From kindergarten to high school to the school of hard knocks, up one learning curve after another, we expand our horizons all the way. We think thoughts that we never thought before. We ask questions we didn't know we had before. We see things from angles we couldn't have imagined before. Widening, widening. We move from job to job and career to career, more widening. We take up different hobbies, pastimes, sports. We travel here, travel there, meet new people, make new friends, widening all the time. We fall in love, have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and with every one, new one that comes along, our heart stretches a little wider, as does our sense of time itself. More and more, we find ourselves thinking back to the generations that have preceded us, perhaps through some interest in family genealogy. And we find ourselves thinking more and more ahead to the generations that are to come. And we wonder what legacy we're going to leave them. We go through changes and challenges, diversions and divorces, disappointments and disease, and the scope of our experience expands still more. We befriend a refugee family or a homeless person, or maybe for a time are homeless ourselves. We live through COVID-19. In one way or another, we're widening all the while. Just as rivers widen as they get closer to the sea, our lives can keep widening as we age. This is part of the paradox of later life. Here's the gerontologist in me speaking. On the one hand, our bodies shrink and stoop, and our range of physical activity tends to narrow in a little more each year. The landscape of action of our lives, if you like, narrows in. But the landscape of consciousness, or what some writer calls our horizon of self-understanding, can continue expanding. Barring maybe the onset of dementia, and that's still an open question, there's no limit to how wide our internal horizon can become. My mother's a pretty good example here. At 99, she lives in one room in a retirement home not far from here, and she can't see worth beans. Macular degeneration, one of the nice things that comes with age sometimes. But she can see just enough to pick up her phone, and with the aid of some pieces of paper on which people, helpers, personal support workers, myself, have written in large numbers and large letters, people's names and phone numbers, she gets on the phone and she calls the various friends, old and young, that she stays connected to on a regular basis, whether it's monthly, weekly, twice a week, or every day, to check in with them, to exchange warm greetings with them, and to tell them that she cares and loves them. Guess how many people are on her list? We sat one day and tallied them up. There are well over 100. Her heart has grown that wide, and it's getting wider every day. Next slide, please. It's not just what we think, but as I say, how we think. It changes with time as we age. Paul writes to the Corinthians, "When I was a child, I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish ways." Studying how people think about complex ethical and moral issues, and our world is filled with them, Harvard psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg proposed various stages of moral reasoning that we tend naturally, but not automatically, to develop according to over time. From the simplistic, sort of self-centered thinking that small children typically engage in, to the higher, more highly principled, broad-minded approach that we may mature into as we get older, what he calls a unity orientation. Now, these stages, says Kohlberg, tell the story of a steady decentering, or what one other scholar calls unselfing, a steady decentering in our orientation towards the wider world. In other words, life is less and less about us and more about the bigger picture, the greater good, which is the kind of universalizing worldview that we find in folks like Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, Mother Teresa, or Greta Thunberg in Sweden, to say nothing of Paul and of Jesus himself. And it's in the same decentering direction that time itself, if we'll let it, will lead us. The kind of black and white, either or, us and them thinking that may have characterized us in our younger years tends to be increasingly replaced by an openness to paradox and contradiction, to ambiguity, and to the complexity of every issue that we can possibly think of, to the gray areas of life. I mean, by the time you're 60, 70, 80, or 90, you've been there, done that, got the t-shirt so many times in so many situations that not so much phases you anymore, does it? Your vision expands to where you can more easily see the whole forest and not get hung up on the details of particular trees. It's this big picture perspective, this long view of things, this widening or this wisening that qualifies older adults in many cultures, not always our own, to be respected as elders. Next slide, please. Spiritual development. All of these forms of development I've been talking about, cognitive, psychosocial, moral, they're all intertwined, of course. And they all play a role in what we would call spiritual development. And aging itself is once again the key. The second half of life, one writer says, is, quote, a great chance for spiritual enlargement. unquote. In his book, Stages of Faith, written in 1981, when stage theories were all the rage, or not so much nowadays, and that's understandable, James Fowler, who later went on to become a professor of pastoral theology at Candler Seminary in Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and I visited there, he traces a similar sort of trajectory as Kohlberg does, whereby we naturally, but not automatically, we naturally, though, tend to widen out in terms of our orientation towards life in general and towards the universe as a whole, which is the broad way in which Fowler defines what faith means. So like Kohlberg, Fowler sees development as an ever-widening process, like climbing a ladder in which every rung goes higher, higher, and we can see further, further. It's a process that leads from the rather childish, literalistic thinking that he calls mythic literal faith, which we can see at work sometimes in fundamentalist circles, to what he calls universalizing faith. Again, the same sort of wide open, all-inclusive orientation we see with a Martin Luther King Jr. It's exceedingly rare, Fowler admits, but it's a potential for us all. It's the goal of that process that we call growing in faith. Are you growing in faith? Next slide, please. I want to shift gears here and talk a little bit about science, which, as you may know from having heard me before, I tend to see as essentially a spiritual endeavor. Science has been defined as, quote, the most persistent and greatest adventure in human history, the search to understand the universe and how it works and where it came from, unquote. Now, to be sure, science has its dark side, as does religion. I think of the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, and a lot of pesticides as cases in point. But science is ultimately about nothing if not ever widening our horizons. And the sky is literally the limit. I recall the wonder that I experienced the night that my binoculars and I honed in on a fuzzy patch of light just down to the right and below the constellation Cassiopeia. It was one of those brilliantly clear, cloudless, moonless nights that we are treated to in a wonderful territory like New Brunswick. Not so much in the metropolitan, well-lit world of Fredericton, but out on the outskirts where I live. A century ago, the astronomer Edwin Hubble of telescope fame determined that that fuzzy patch that I was looking at was not, as previously thought, a cloud of stellar dust within our own Milky Way, but rather an entire galaxy all its own, Andromeda, which is in fact our nearest neighbor in our neighborhood of galaxies. And that blue sky high overnight, our notion of just how big our universe actually is. And what is more, Hubble determined that Andromeda is moving away from us, a discovery that helped to lay the foundation for the so-called Big Bang theory. The history of astronomy, Hubble once famously said, the history of astronomy is a history of receding horizons. Not only has the universe itself been continually expanding, because it's an unfolding process, but so also has our conception of the universe. The universe of Stephen Hawking is wider and weirder than that of Albert Einstein, or of Isaac Newton before Einstein, or of Galileo before Newton. The more our knowledge of the cosmos advances, the stranger things turn out to be. Says the scientist J.B.S. Haldane, quote, the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. Our universe, we're learning, abounds in bizarre things like black holes and wormholes, and in many dimensions beyond the three or four of length, breadth, height, and time that we experience every day. And plus, some 70% of the universe, we're learning, is made up of stuff that we can't even see, dark matter, dark energy. Not only are there multiple dimensions, but there may well be, it's proposed, a multiverse, compared to which our own universe, with its billions of galaxies and its millions of life-bearing planets, oftentimes with I'm sure, intelligent life, as intelligent, if not more intelligent than here on planet Earth. Our universe is but one bubble in a sea of universes. At least this is the kind of science fiction-y possibility that scientists working and wondering at the edges of their respective fields seriously consider. And some of those books sitting on my little bookshelf beside my favorite reading chair, I don't understand the formulas at all. I don't have a hope in wherever to understand the formulas, but I get the concepts and they excite me. As one vast adventure into the mysteries of the cosmos, science runs by, is fueled by wonder. Wonder, says the Scottish theologian Thomas Carlyle, is the beginning of worship. Science and spirituality, broadly conceived, are not enemies, but allies. And together there is so much to learn. Each can enrich and needs the other. Science without religion, Einstein wrote, is blame, but religion without science is blind. I have this in next slide, please, Patty. I have this intriguing book at home entitled Children of the Living Universe. It's written by a cosmologist named Paul Von Ward. What he says near the end of it sends chills up my spine each time I read it, chills of excitement and wonder and awe. And I think it points us toward the need for what's been called a cosmotheology, which is a new term that I stumbled on in preparing for today. Let me read what Von Ward writes. I stand under the starlit sky. Next slide, please. I stand under the starlit sky and glory in the existence of innumerable conscious beings clustered throughout the universe. I no longer wish to hide in my human uniqueness, but yearn to reach out to the entire family of consciousness across the galaxies and through the dimensions to pool our human wisdom in a partnership of beings that vaults everyone to the next expansive plane of cosmic development. For a truly cosmotheology, when I say cosmo, I'm not talking about that dance hall down the road, which some of you may remember, okay? For a truly cosmotheology, a theology that can accommodate the cosmos itself in all its complexity and mystery, we need to widen out our conception of God. And that may require opening ourselves to concepts that come from traditions besides our own, like Taoism, or Buddhism, or Judaism, or Islam, or indigenous spirituality, to name just a few. We need to think big when it comes to God. A book I often go back to is entitled, Your God is Too Small. I wonder if anybody's ever read that. It's written by a New Testament translator, J.B. Phillips, and it examines the various conceptions of God, often quite simplistic and limiting, that we were perhaps introduced to as children, but never consciously critiqued or upgraded. So as our knowledge and our experience widens in the various ways that I've been talking about this morning, sadly, our notion of the divine, of the mysterium tremendum, or of the old one, as Einstein used to say, tends to not to keep pace, which can leave us deep down feeling terribly adrift and at sea. And I think a lot of young people, like students that I work with in my capacity as a prof, are feeling that adriftness, that at seaness. Here's what J.B. Phillips says. He wrote it in 1954, but I believe his words are still valid today. Many men and women today, he writes, are living often with inner dissatisfaction, without any faith in God at all. This is not because they are particularly wicked or selfish, or as the old-fashioned would say, godless, but because, because they have not found with their adult minds a God big enough to account for life, big enough to fit in with the new scientific age, big enough to command their highest admiration and respect, and consequently their willing cooperation. Widening our horizons. This is what science is driven by, And it's what life itself and spirituality drives us to do. It's certainly the vision that drove Paul and others to travel far and wide in spreading the good news about the all-inclusive nature of the love of the mystery we call God. We're still in the season of Easter, so that good news takes in death as well. Next slide, please. Many think of death as the final frontier, as the end of the road. But viewed from a wide enough angle, it may simply be a horizon that's so broad our five senses can't see beyond it. I mentioned that in my last talk here. That's how Pierre Teilhard de Chardin saw things. Equal parts scientist and priest, he wrote once about, quote, the hidden mystery in the womb of death. I'll say that again, the hidden mystery in the womb of death. Death, this suggests, is not termination, but transition. Not ending so much as beginning, as birth, which nicely removes its sting, as Paul would often say. Now, since we're veering clearly here into mystical territory, let's let the poet Oliver Wendell Holmes have the final word. The poem is called The Chambered Nautilus. I hope some of you have learned this poem in school. Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. Leave thy low vaulted past. Let each new temple, nobler than the last, shut thee from heaven with a dome more vast, till thou at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea. Thank you.